Good morning. If you weren't here last week, the elders surprised me at the end of service and put me on the spot. I had one of you to point out to me, that's what it's like, preacher, every time you talk about one of us in your lesson. It's not so fun when they're talking about you. And so, yes, it is humbling and a little embarrassing for that much praise to be put on me, undeservingly so, but it was worth every penny I paid to Tom to say all those nice things last week. Thank you, Tom. If you ask any preacher about a preacher being at a church for, say, 20 years, they will tell you that says as much or more about the congregation than it does the preacher. Preachers don't stay at a church if the church is not full of loving people and the elders aren't loving and supportive. And so, church, you need to know that the fact that we're still in partnership is a big blessing, and there's a big thank you that I want to extend on how you've loved me and my family and been supportive. And I want to point out the elders that I've worked with in the time I've been here, from Keith Thompson, David Watkins, back a little further, Homer Weathers and Lee Smith, Greg Foster, Tom Sism, these men, and we have a perfectly timed appearance by Greg Foster here this morning. I want you to know how great the shepherds that you've appointed have been here. These elders, they have always, I always knew they had my back. And they have encouraged me and they have spurred me, and but they've always been for me. And I always knew that, and that's a big deal. And I need to mention that, you know, shepherds don't get the encouragement that ministers get, but they need it. And so, church, remember that. And Bob Fitzgerald has been a huge encouragement to me, and Bob was here before I came, and he's still serving. And so for 20 years for me, it's 22 or 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever it is for Bob serving. And it's priceless to have elders that are godly men that shepherd our souls. It's a big deal. And so for us now to have Curtis on board and the future's bright, church. So we're in this together. And turn in your Bibles, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10. Today's sermon, I hope, will kind of keep us pointed in the right direction. And you may notice that it is from this week's reading. If you're reading through the New Testament with us, and the bulletin keeps us on track, there's a note of that in the bulletin, what this week's reading is, 1 Corinthians 1:10. This was in last week's reading. And a great passage about, you know, a church and what we are to be about. And verse 10 says, Paul says, I appeal to you, brothers, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and in the same judgment. There is a lot of joy as a parent, as you get older as a parent, and when your children are in harmony, there's a lot of joy in that. Having two teenagers, there's those moments sometimes are not as often as they used to be when my younger two are in harmony. But this past week, 4th of July, holidays, hopefully you enjoyed some time with family or friends during that time. And there's a snapshot in my mind of my girls playing in the pool together and enjoying each other and being in harmony. And I crop out the dog. He was a part of that harmony, but I crop him out. And I have this really, for a father, it's a neat picture. Those moments are special as parents when your children are in harmony. And Paul, that's what Paul's talking about, his spiritual children. And when we are in harmony, when there's harmony here, God, that's precious to God, isn't it? It's precious because that's what the church is to be. We are one body. There's to be no divisions. In verse 11, there was a situation in Corinth. Paul says, it's been reported to me by Chloe's people that there is quarreling among you. Verse 12, what I mean is that one of you says, I follow Paul, or I follow Apollos, or I follow Cephas, or I follow Christ. So in the church, Paul says, I want you to agree, but what I'm hearing is you're not agreeing. You're divided. Some of you are after this person, some are after another person. And notice that one of these is Paul, by the way. Some of these people are, I follow Paul. And Paul's telling them, that's not what this is about. You're not to follow me. You're to follow Christ. But notice the wording here in these statements. Notice what they say. As I've read this in the past, I've always noticed the divisiveness. What I've not really picked up on is, notice the first two words in each of these statements. I follow Cephas. I follow Paul. I follow Christ. Here's who I follow. I understand you. I don't know what you're about, but I'm about this. And that's divisive. What things divide us? What things divide us here? We're a body in this room. There's give or take 250 of us, and there are 250 different opinions about a lot of things, right? What divides us? Our personalities divide us. Some of our personalities are easy for you to get along with. Some are not easy for you to get along with. How we do things divides us. When decisions are made, and decisions have been made in the past, sometimes that can divide us. They're going to be made in the future. There's coming a day, God willing, God help us, when we have new carpet in this room. There's coming a day, church. God willing, it will not be orange, and I might be the only one that feels that way. And so maybe you all want it to be orange, and it will be. I don't know. But God help us to agree on it, right? And whatever things are done in the future, decisions that have to be made, church, we're one body. And the devil, anytime the devil has something that divides us, whatever it be, that's another tool in his toolbox. He has a whole arsenal of them. He loves them. Anything that divides us, right? But Christ is what unites us. Verse 13, Paul goes on. He says, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? And the answer, of course, is no. Paul was correct in that he did not desire a following for him. A lot of preachers desire a following for them. If Paul had the technology we have and he was on TV, his sermons were recorded and broadcast on TV, and you turn to his channel, I highly doubt it would read Apostle Paul Ministries. It may be a good marketing tool. It may be a good, that may be a good method for a lot of things. So I'm throwing small stones, but I don't think that's what Paul would have done. Maybe it would have been some ministry with the name of Jesus in it, because Paul pointed people to Christ. Verse 14, he said, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one may say that you were baptized in my name. I did baptize also the household of Stephanus. Beyond that, I do not know whether I baptized anyone else. This sometimes gets misused and misquoted as to minimize the importance of baptism. Sometimes this will get pulled out to say, look, baptism's not important. Look, Paul said he didn't really care about baptism, and that's not the case. What Paul is saying is he's thankful in this circumstance that he only baptized a few, himself personally, because, and don't miss the reason. He said, I'm glad I didn't baptize more of you because, so that no one may say you were baptized in my name. Paul realizes this church is divided and some of them are following me. They're not all following Christ. Some are following me. And that's why he was glad he didn't baptize more. Verse 17 says, for Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. God did not send Paul to baptize. I would say the same thing. God didn't send me to baptize. As a preacher, I am to preach the gospel. When people are baptized, it's their choice and their conversion. And the point Paul's making here is the baptizer is not important. It's not important. It's an honor. And if I could say it this way, I'm kind of torn on this statement here. But I do not have a record of those I've baptized throughout my career as a minister. I wished I did, because sometimes that's helpful to know, for me to know. But I don't have a record of that. I never started a record. And part of the reason I didn't start a record of that is it's not important that I baptize someone. What's important is they were baptized. They were baptized into Christ. That's what's important. And so Paul is just making, he's making the point here. He says, I'm a vehicle, but I'm not the message. And the messenger is not important. And the baptizer is not important. It's the one that's being baptized and the one that's saving them. And that's Jesus Christ. Notice the second part of this verse 17 is very important. He says, he's talking about preaching the gospel, but he says, not with words of eloquent wisdom. Not with words of eloquent wisdom. And the point Paul's making is, don't follow me because my message was eloquently put. And this is a tricky thing for us to do in this day and age, church, because I had a professor in college say on an occasion, he said, no one has the right to make the Bible boring. And that's a true, that I still agree with that. This book is powerful. And if it's boring, you're not reading it right, you're not listening to it right, and no speaker should make it boring. My job should make it as glorious as it is. But church, it's not in the messenger, right? It's not the one delivering the message. It's what the message is. And that's what Paul's saying. The message of the cross is not because it was, you were not saved because it was eloquently put. You were not saved because it was so well presented. You were not saved because the speaker just wowed you and was so motivational. That's not it. That's not why we're here. We're not here because the message is delivered so well in the sense of it being inspiring. We're here because of Jesus Christ. The message is inspiring, not how it's delivered. Verse 18, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Let me back up just one second. Oftentimes, churches struggle when I'll just say it the way most people say it, when a charismatic preacher leaves. I say charismatic because that word kind of captures what I'm talking about, and that is some preachers in all types of churches, an audience gathers. Our church may grow. They like the way the preacher preaches. True? True. And churches... it is so sad to see when those preachers leave or retire or what have you, that church's attendance declines. Anyone seen that? Heard of it? You think that grieves God? I think it grieves God. I think it shows God sometimes as sheep we are shallow. We're shallow. God, I love you if your message is delivered in a really palatable way to me. I love you, God. I mean, I can listen to your word from certain good preachers. But if the preacher is not really good at talking, God, I'm kind of out on that. I think that grieves God. And it will grieve any... genuine preacher, if he leaves or retires and the attendance goes down, that's a sad sight. And church, I encourage you now, no matter who stands here and speaks to you or how easy they are to listen to or difficult. And I've been in congregations where it was difficult. It was difficult. I couldn't always understand what he's saying. I get confused. I get sleepy. But I'm not there for the messenger. I'm there for the message. And I hope we as a church, I hope you're here because of Jesus Christ. And if the message is delivered, if the speaker does a good job and delivers it well, that's a bonus. But God help us if we don't come just because we don't like how it's being presented. If it's true, it's true. And that's what Paul is saying here. Verse 18, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. As people, we like things that are powerful. We're kind of awed by those, and this past week is no exception. At my house, we're a little different. We do fireworks, but we do the tame kind. We like the smoke bombs and the place. I'm not the only one that likes smoke bombs, folks. When I went to buy my stuff, they were out of smoke bombs. We like those. Like the little worms, like those. We like the sparklers, the old-fashioned kind. I like the new-fashioned kind. That's how we roll at my house. We like that kind of stuff. We don't do the black cats. We don't do the cherry bombs. We don't do the M80s. We don't do none of that. We just don't. I don't like the loud boom. But I get the appeal of it because as people, we like power. We like things that kind of awe us, don't we? Who of you likes the loud fireworks? Raise your hand. Don't be ashamed. I know I've called you all out. That's okay. We like things that are powerful. Now, I do like watching things go boom and kind of, you know, right? I don't know why I do. We like things that are powerful. I remind you, Christianity is not about power that humans define as power. We're not here because God overwhelmed us with a powerful message in the way that people that humans define power. It's not that kind of power. It's a different kind of power. It's not the power in the delivery of the message or the eloquent words. It's the power of God. Verse 19, he says, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Verse 20, where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? In the first century, the wise person was the scholar, the scribe, and the wise person was the philosopher. In the first century, philosophers ruled the day as far as wisdom, and they had different ways of reasoning and different methods of logic, but names like Plato and Socrates, we've heard those names. They were famous. That's who was considered the experts of the first century and that time, that ancient time period. Today, it's the scientist. In our day and age, if God were asking this question now, if Paul were asking, who's the wise? Well, in our society, it's the scientist. But God has made the wise seem foolish, because the wise, in human terms, they can't find God. They don't understand God. In the first century, to the philosophers, God didn't make sense. And in our day and age, to the scientists, they can't find him. So they don't believe in him. And God makes them look foolish. But the cross is where it's at for us. To the philosopher, the cross doesn't make sense. A God coming and dying? No. And to the scientist, if God is not observable, if he's not testable, if he's not provable, then faith is foolish. That's what scientists say. We know that to be false, but this verse makes so much sense even 2,000 years later. Verse 21, for since the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom. It pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. Church, the world did not discover God through wisdom. And God made it so that... So in the first century, the philosopher was not the one to discover God and then present God to everyone else. True? It came through Jesus Christ, and it came through him crucified. In our day and age, God has made it so that the scientists will not discover God and then bring that knowledge back to humanity. That's the point here. The smart ones don't find God and then teach the rest of us. God has chosen to reveal himself in ways that to the smart human seems foolish. Scientists will never discover God. Because, and I have a video to share with you in a moment that kind of makes a well-worded point in this regard, and that is, a God that would create a physical universe is not in the physical universe. He did not start in the physical. He had to be outside the physical. The God that created everything is outside of what he created. Does that make sense? He's not in it. And so scientists will never discover God. Why? He's not in this physical universe. He's outside of it. And the wisdom of this world is foolishness to God. The Jews, they demanded signs. The Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. When people don't believe in a creator, they may laugh at the ones who have faith and say, how can you have faith in a creator you cannot explain? And we would say to them, how can you have faith in a scientific explanation that you cannot explain? How we got here, how everything started, how it came to be. I want to share about a 2-minute video that was made a little while back, but this is a debate between those who, the first gentleman is a non-believer, and then the man who answers, who stands up, is the one who is a Christian. Testing one, testing two. All right, I'll have my audiovisual experts in the sound room pull up my video. And if they cannot retrieve it from the PowerPoint, it is saved in worship media under Is There a God? I like how, you know, the person that you'll see here in a minute, how he speaks about God being outside of time, space, or matter. When you hear him talking about that, you get lost there if you're like me. And I have to go back and analyze it a little bit. But part of the point that he makes is he uses an illustration about a computer. The one who creates a computer is not inside the computer. And so I want to remind you, church, that for those of the scientific community, and it's not all scientists. Sometimes I use that word and kind of lump them all together. But Curtis Price is a scientist. There are many scientists that believe in God, but there are many that don't. And the ones that don't, I remind you of this. The very nature of science has rules, and consider it a lane. Stay in your lane. Science is a lane, and their lane is, if they can't touch it, test it, observe it, repeat it, they don't believe it. Does that make sense? And so that's what they will talk about is what. So for the scientists to explain how we got here, their lane is all they will consider. Does that make sense? If that is all there. So if you're a scientist, the only explanation for us, I say, a scientist that is that narrows themselves to only what's testable and provable, then they cannot consider a God that's outside of that because they cannot test that. Okay, so I'm going to check with my sound guy. If we're dead in the water, which it appears we are, then I will share one more thing about that video, and then we'll move on. So he makes the point that in the material universe, there is time, there's matter, and there is space. And those three come into existence at the same time. If you have something at a certain time but no space, where was it put? A certain item that's in a place but it has no matter, then there's no substance. And so time, space, and matter are what make up our physical universe. Genesis 1:1, what does Genesis 1:1 say? In the beginning, which is time, God created the heavens and the earth. The heavens is the space, the earth is the matter. And so Genesis 1:1 shows the way God created the physical universe, he did it at once with those three elements. And the point that this person is making is the reason we can't show where God came from is God is outside of us. And the final thing he said that I thought was very noteworthy, he said, if my small brain could comprehend an eternal God that would make all of this, he's not worth worshiping. He's not worth worshiping. So when the scientist says to the believer, to the Christian, when the scientist says, show me your God, and we may, don't feel bad, church, that you can't show someone your God, because God is so big, he is not to be fully understood by creation. True? And that's the God that we believe in. Verse 27. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. He chose, verse 28 says, he chose what is low. And we need to remember that when we come to God, we don't come to God because we were smart enough. It's not that we were strong enough. It's not that we were great enough. And it's none of us were morally good enough. The message of the cross is so amazing because it's not about us. It's about Christ. And I have a picture that I kind of debated whether to use this or not. The cross is a, or should I say, symbols and images and those type things that represent Christ or Christianity. God, we don't worship images. True? We don't worship images. God is not found in something that we can make. And so we're careful about that. But the reason I like this picture is, it kind of illustrates this final verse that says, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. If we're going to be proud about something, church, if we're going to boast, if you're ever going to boast, boast in Jesus Christ. Amen. Don't boast in what you do. Don't boast in what we do. We don't exalt us. We exalt Jesus Christ. And that's what unifies us. And that's what I liked about that picture is that it kind of illustrates people being proud of something. What they're proud of is not themselves, not what they've accomplished, but what Jesus Christ accomplished when he died for us. May we always unite around the cross, right? May we always unite around the cross. We're going to sing a song of encouragement. And it's a good song because it reminds us, God, you have your way with me. It's not my way. It's not what I want. God, it's what you want. And if you're here this morning and there's a need that you have, bring it to the foot of the cross. Bring it to the throne of God. Let us surrender before him. If one's never had their sins washed away, we'd love to stop and help you do that and become a Christian this morning. So if you would, come while we stand and sing.
Would you live for Jesus and be all the good and good? Would you walk with him within the narrow road? Would you have to bear your burden, carry all your load? Let him have his way with thee. His power can make you what you ought to be. His blood can cleanse your heart and make you free. His love can fill your soul and you will see. 'Twas best for him to have his way with thee. Would you have him make you free and follow at his call? Would you know the peace that comes by hearing all? Would you have him save you so that you'd be never fall?